Melna Vyakya Prakatita Parabrahma Tattvam Yuvanam Varashishtante Vasadrishikanairavratam Brahma Nishtai Acharyendram Karakalita Chinmudram Anandamurtim Swatma Ramam Mudita Vadanam Dakshinamurti Nide. Prayer verse. Let's go to verse 10. So repeat after me. Sarvatmatvamiti Sarvatmatvamiti Sputi kritamidam Sputi kritamidam Yasmat amushmin stave Yasmat amushmin stave Tenasya shravanat tadartamananat Tenasya shravanat tadartamananat Dhyanatcha sankirtana Dhyanatcha sankirtana Sarvatmatva mahavibhuti sahitam Sarvatmatva mahavibhuti sahitam Syat ishwaratvam swataha Syat ishwaratvam swataha Siddhetat punarashtada parinatam Siddhetat punarashtada parinatam Chaishwaryam avyahatam Chaishwaryam avyahatam Sandhi Sarva atmatvam iti Sarva atmatvam iti Sarva atmatvam iti Sputi kritam idam Yasmat amushmin stave tena asya shravanat tat artha mananat dhyanat cha sankirtanat sarva atmatva maha vibhuti sahitam syat Ishwaratvam Swataha Siddhyet Tat Punar Ashtada Parinatam Cha Aishwaryam Avyahatam. For Sanskrit people, breaking the Sandhi. Okay. Dakshinamurti apparently is really only 8 verses, and the last 2 verses, 9 and 10, are just kind of giving the pulla, the, you know, verses of praise, and also giving the results of what great things happen to you if you study these. That's often, you know, the last verse of some of these, what they call prakarana granthas, would be if you study this, you will gain such and such. So there's some of that in this. It's a beautiful verse. So, sarvatma tva. When you put tva on the end of a noun, it means the ness, N-E-S-S, you know, like awareness, consciousness, sarvatma-ness. So sarvatma means the self of all. So that state of being the self of all, that's your nature, the one, the atma that you are, this atma that you are, is the atma of all beings. There's only one atma. So the sarvatma is the self, which is yourself, right? When you say, I am an existent being. This innermost self, which is yourself, is in fact the self of all beings. So say, each one of us says, you know, I am, I am, I am, I am, I am. Your mind is making a statement. There's a word. Your mind is labeling something. When you say, I, your mind is labeling something. And what it's labeling is you, you know. Whether I say, I am my body, or I am tall, or I am short, or I am happy, or I am sad. The I is labeling the being, the person who is taking on all of these different roles, right? So the person, I am sad, I was sad, now I am happy, you know. I was hungry, and now I am full. But the I is the constant. The I is the one that the mind is mind labels as the one, as the conscious being, the me, that is experiencing all of these different conditions. Whether I, even in reference to my sense organs, I am seeing, I am hearing, I am tasting. The I is the one who is the constant amidst all of these experiences. So here, one normally takes this I, you know, normally takes this me, this very personal me, to be one with whatever experience you happen to be having at the moment. Like, for instance, if I say I am seeing, then I become united with this act of seeing. If I say I am hearing, I become united with the act of hearing. I say I am feeling, I am sad, I am happy, I am sad, I become united with that particular experience. And the thing is, all of these experiences that I as though become united with, that I take on to be myself, are in fact coming and going. The only one thing is not coming and going, and that is me, the I that is present to all of the experiences. And since I am the one present to all of the experiences, and all of the experiences, whether they're sensory experiences or emotional experiences or conceptual experiences, or even the ahankar, the I thought itself, since all of these are in constant flux, coming and going, they can't be me. They are my experiences, okay, we can start with that, but they can't actually be me because they come and go and I remain as the constant. So if I'm to gain self-knowledge, the task is to be able to have some viveka, some discrimination, to be able to differentiate myself from the experiences that are coming and going. Otherwise, I don't bother. You know, I'm interested in the experiences, and if the experience happens to be something in reference to my body, my mind, or my sense organs, I just identify myself with that. But viveka, some analysis, some discriminative analysis of the experience will differentiate, really, the one who is labeled as aham, labeled as I, from the changing experiences that are coming into that field of experience. So now, when we take the word I, or the Atma, the self, as a word, like all words, it is labeling something, right? Like, I use this lamp all the time, lamp. The word lamp, L-A-M-P, lamp, is labeling this lamp, this object, right? So if I say, look at the lamp, probably you're not looking at my mouth that's saying lamp, right? I say, look at the lamp, the word lamp guides you to this, right? So like that, the word Atma, or the word self, or the word me, or the word I, this I, has to guide you. The word has to, you have to see, guide you in the sense that you have to see where this word lands. We use the word all of the time, I. Where does the word land? Right? Initially, it lands upon your presence amidst an experience. Like, say, if I have a thought in my mind, say an emotion, I am agitated. I am, right? There's the am that's landing on me, but there's also the agitation. But if I just stop with the I am's landing on me, and then it's lassoing to itself the experience. So I am happy, I am sad, I am... What we want to do is divide that. We want to do some viveka, discriminate the I am from the changing experiences. So just notice, now when we're talking about this, the way that we're using these words, say if I'm saying to you, I want to be able to differentiate me, the I am, from the experience I'm having. I am an experience, not as an object, but I am the conscious being which is having the experience, right? So both are here, me and the experience. Me, the one who's present to all of the experiences, and then the changing experiences. So in Vedanta, the task is, the whole teaching methodology has to do with using words to point, to the reality of the experiences that you're having, to help you to differentiate your self-experience, which is not an object to look at, to differentiate you, the subject, from all of the things that you can objectify. And so this whole 10 verses that have in one way or another start with that, and then they take us to a different level. They start with that, making you try to recognize the constant me, your own presence, and then to realize that you, your own presence, this me, is not in fact changing as your experiences come and go. That's step one. I can do it in a lot of different orders, but for now, this is step one. I recognize that I am not changing as my experiences are coming and going. That's a viveka. That's a differentiation. Then we have to realize, if that is true, if experiences can come and go, and I remain, right? Say a thought comes and goes, and I remain, I have no connection with that thought. But it may depend upon me for its being and for its awareness, but it goes and I remain. And so therefore, I'm not it. I can say, it is me, it depends upon me for its awareness and for its being, but I don't depend upon it in any way. That's why we use this word asanga. I'm not attached. In fact, one meditation is asangoham. Asangoham means my being, which is present to all of these experiences, never goes through any modification or attachment at all as the experiences come and go. So I'm asanga. If I am asanga, if I'm not attached to any given experience, whether it be the I thought itself or a mood or emotion or the physical body, you know, any perceptions, if I'm not attached, if I'm asanga, because all of these things come and go, and you are a sangha, it's the same situation for you, then my atma, that when I say my atma, you know, who's the my here? I can say, when I say I'm my atma, myself, I'm talking from the standpoint of my body, my sense organs, my mind, all of the things for which I'm a sangha. You know, these, all of these perceptions come and go, and it's the same for you. That being so, what divides me, the self, the conscious being, this presence that I am, from the conscious presence which you are? Because for you also, all experience is coming and going, coming and going. For me, all experience is coming and going, coming and going. Even the ahankara, even the I thought. And so, really, if I remove from myself all of the things that can be objectified, my body, my mind, my sense organs, my moods, my emotions, my perceptions, you know, I remove all of those, and you remove all of that from you, then what makes me, the one who's remaining, the constant me, different from you? What makes me, me and you, you, then? Just think about it. If I get rid of all the bodies, because they're objectified, and you get rid of the sense organs because they're objectified and changing. You get rid of the thoughts in the mind because they're objectified and changing. You get rid of the I thought because that's also just a thought, you know. Say, what about space? Space is also objectified. Get rid of all of these things. And then where is the dividing line then between the awareful being that I am and the awareful being that you are? So all of these methodologies in Vedanta are meant to make you recognize I, my own presence, is not an object in the creation which I can look at and differentiate from another object. I can't take this awareful being that I am and look at it, make it join duality, make it be an object within the dual world. It's not possible for me to divide myself up as a conscious being, aware of a conscious being, where I can have a subject-object relationship with my body, my mind, and my sense organs, all of these things. I can be aware of it. I can describe it. I can differentiate one thought from another thought. I can differentiate one perception from another perception. But how can you differentiate me from me? Awareness from awareness. I can't objectify it to do that. I can only be it. I can only be the conscious being. It's a good aware. It's a very beautiful meditation to just become aware of yourself, kind of the one who lights up everything. Just your own presence. It's not lighting up as a knower. It's lighting up just as your simple abiding presence. And then try to make it do something. Try to divide it in half. Try to make one half aware of the other half. Try to do anything to it. And it is a sangha completely. There's no way to touch it, to make it different, to change it. It simply is as it is. And that is true for all beings. And so, because that's true, the Atma, that yourself, is non-objectifiable, there's no way to make there be two. The Atma can't be an object. Like I can say there's 20 bodies in the room. But I can't, like I can say there's 20 bodies in the room, there's, you know, 20 sets of sense organs in the room, 20 minds in the room. Everybody has a different thought at this moment in the room. All of these things we can say. But can we say there are 20 selves in the room? You can only say there's 20 selves in the room if you take yourself to be something that you are looking at, right? That you're objectifying. And that you can't do. And so here, he starts this final verse saying, this sarvatmatvam, this being the one self for everything. Sarva means all. This state of being the self of the whole creation, the self of all that is. He says, this sarva, this sarvatmatvam iti, this is sputi kritam idam. This sarvatmatvam, this state of you being the one self, which is the self of all that is. This, he says, is sputi kritam. This has been made clear. He says, sputi kritam means to make. Sputi kritam. This has been made clear. Clear like in a crystal. Like a crystal is a spatika. Mm-hmm. It's very clear. You can see through it, and the sun just reverberates in it. That's a crystal spatika. This is sputi kritam. This sarvatmatvam, your nature, as being the self and all beings, he says, sputi kritam, this has been made clear, amushmin stave, in this stava, in these shlokas, in this Dakshinamurti stotram. Okay? Amushmin means in this stave, means in this work. These shlokas that we have just done, these 10 shlokas. Now he goes like this. First he says, yasmat, because since this has been made very clear to you in this work, now that we're on the 10th. Since this is no problem now, this is clear, since this is clear, clear like a crystal, he says, tena, therefore, tasya shravanat, he says, from, he's giving it the whole teaching methodology now, from your doing shravana on this, first of all, shravana. From doing shravana means from exposing yourself to this teaching, not just exposing yourself, to shravana means for you to thoroughly understand what the Shruti, now in the form of these 10 verses, what the Shruti has to say. That is shravana. The shravana takes place through the study of the Vedas, through the study of the Upanishads, as taught by your teacher. You know, that's the shravana. The shravana means that what the Shruti has to say is made clear to you, so that you know what the Shruti says. You know, you understand what the Upanishad says. So that, say, for instance, if the like in the Chandogya Upanishad, there's a Mahavakya, Tattvamasi, that thou art. That's what the Shruti says, that thou art. You are that. What does that mean? For Shravana, the teacher has to unfold exactly what the Shruti means by saying you are that. Because it literally means you, the jiva, you, the individual, you are Ishwara. you are Ishvara, you are the Lord. Another way you can take it is you, the Pratyagatma, the innermost self, are Brahman, the one self, the infinite self, which is the self of all beings. That's all that's Mahavakya. Now, in doing Shravana, the teacher has to make you understand why that's what the Shruti is saying. Like you could say, Tattvamasi, maybe they mean you are part of Ishvara. Maybe that's what the Shruti means. When you're analyzing the Sanskrit and everything, couldn't it mean that? And so there's a lot of questioning about what the Shruti or what the Upanishads or what the teaching is actually saying. That's Shravana, the revealing to you beyond any doubt what all of what is the tat, what they call the tat parya, what is the tat parya, what is the essence that is being unfolded to you to make you see that clearly, what the Shruti has to say. So say, now you understand, that's Shravana. So therefore, from Shravana, now you've understood clearly what the Shruti has to say. But then, that's not enough. Because then you could say, next one is Tadartha Mananam. Then after you've understood what the Shruti, what the Upanishads have to say, the vision of the Upanishads, then your mind, you can say, is it really that? I don't know if I accept what the Shruti says. I know what they say. That's Shravana. I know what it says. But I don't believe it. Why couldn't it be like this? Or it doesn't have to be the, I don't believe it. You know, for a mumukshu, it's not really so much as a belief, because it's not so much of an I don't believe it, because then you are approaching the Shruti in a way where you're not, your primary goal is maybe not to learn. So it would be more like, instead of I don't believe it, it would be like, I don't understand why it couldn't be like this. Why does it have to be like this? See what I mean? Like, for instance, the Shruti will say, the Sarvatmatvam, you are the self in all beings. There is only one self. You know? Advaita, there is no second thing. You could say, why can't there be many? Why couldn't there just be many conscious beings that are illumining many physical bodies? That each one of us has our own conscious being. Why couldn't it be like that? Why do you say it's only one conscious being? That's more Sankhya. Why can't this physical world be, you know, a physical real entity? And this physical world, and in this physical world, there are many bodies, and each body has its own Purusha, its own conscious being. Or why couldn't you say, who says there's a stable conscious being? Maybe that stable conscious being that you say is there is really an illusion. Maybe the stable conscious being is more like a candle flame. It looks stable from the outside, but when you analyze it, it's, you know, it's a flicker, flicker, flicker. That's more like the Kshanika Vijnanavada. So why couldn't it be like that? That's Manana. And so all of these doubts that come up have to be dealt with. If your student says to you, well, why can't it be like that? You have to be able to say, well, it can't be like that because of this and that and this and that and this and that. And then the student will say, yeah, but then it could be like this. You know? And so whether it's a teacher-student dialogue that's taking place or a dialogue that's going on in your own mind, that dialogue has to go on, and it has to be resolved. That's what knowledge is about. That's what knowledge is. If the mind doesn't resolve those doubts, then there isn't really any knowledge. You know, like say, for instance, just to kind of understand where these things are important, because when we're talking about self-knowledge, we are talking about knowledge. We're not talking about self-knowledge filled with doubts. We don't call that knowledge. So say, for instance, you had, if I held up, this is the often example we use, if I held up a flower to you, beautiful rose, and you're looking at it, and oh, what a beautiful rose. And then I ask you, do you think, is this rose real? You know? Or is it an artificial rose? And then you would probably say, if you've had any experience with artificial flowers, you would probably say, I don't know. And so now, at this point, first it was just, oh, what a beautiful rose. But then when you start inquiring, or somebody asks you, is this rose real or artificial? You're not sure. It takes more inquiry, right? And so then you might have to come up and smell it. And then you'll still say, well, you know, that could be rose oil. And you're right, too. And you can get up to an artificial rose, you can get right up to it, and you still can't tell. It's an amazing thing. I've actually experienced this. And so then, you're going to say, well, I have to touch it. And I actually had the experience once with one of these things of touching, and I still wasn't sure until I really kind of pulled on it. And then I realized it was kind of a plastic, you know. So what I'm saying is that inquiry is necessary for there to be knowledge. Now say the rose is there, I'm holding up the rose, and at first you just think it's a rose. You have a knowledge of the rose through your sense perception, but then a doubt comes. Is that really a rose or an artificial rose? Now what do you call that state? It's not knowledge. It's doubt. You're in a state of doubt. You need to inquire. You can't say whether... You don't have knowledge of the rose. You have knowledge of this object that looks like a rose, but you don't know whether it's a rose or whether it's an artificial rose. You don't know until you inquire into it. So that we don't call that knowledge. It's not knowledge until you can say this is a rose and you don't have any doubt and it's over with. There comes a time when you say, this is a rose, and I will stand by that. Nobody can tell me otherwise. See what I mean? So that's knowledge. Now, here, with self-knowledge is like that, you know, where I have to be able to recognize myself, and I don't have any doubt about it. Nothing can come in to shake it. It's called nishta. That's what knowledge is nishta. The example they use for nishta is, say, this is an ancient example too. Say if I dig a post hole, and I stick a post in it, and then the first time I put the post in it, it's very wobbly. So I have to squash a bunch of dirt down in it, pounds of dirt in it. And then it's not as wobbly, but it's still wobbly. You know, I go like this, and it pushes the dirt out, and so now it becomes wobbly again. I stuff more dirt into it, and it's a little wobbly, more into it, a little wobbly, until finally I can't move it. That's nishta. There's clarity there. There's just clarity there. You see the whole thing, and nothing can get in. Your mind can no longer negate it. That's knowledge. But until your mind has that level of satisfaction, there's not nishta there, there's not knowledge there. You know? And it's not like the teacher can teach you, you know, but it's your mind that has to see and recognize. You know, the teacher can't do that for you. You know, it's your mind that has to be able to say, yes, it's a rose, you know, or yes, I am that. And you can't pretend. Knowledge isn't about pretend. You can say, well, I believe that. You know, we're not talking about belief. I believe that. That's right. We have a lot of faith and that type of thing. That has its own usefulness. But faith isn't knowledge. Or belief isn't knowledge. I have faith in that. You know, and hopefully someday... I have faith. I believe that there's a God. I believe in God. No. But I don't know. I just have that faith. You know? I don't know what God is like or who God is, but I believe there must be a God. And I would like to meet him one day. You know? So knowledge is the meeting. It's different than the faith. So here, manana has to, shravana has to do with actually gaining the vision of the shruti. It's really the operation of that pramana, the shruti, as a means of knowledge. And manana is the putting your mind to it, you know, so that you yourself see, you know. And you can't fool yourself. You know, you can't pretend to see. And that's useless anyway. That's why in the East in general, you know, they don't protect religion. They don't have, or people's spirituality. They don't have that idea where, you know, you have to be politically correct and all of that type of thing, where all paths lead to the same goal, and even though they're all saying something totally different, still, you know, all paths lead to the same goal, that type of thing. You know, that's true. There's a lot of truth in that. All paths lead to the same goal. Like if you have a goal that has nothing to do with knowledge. It's just like if I want to go to town, say if I want to go to San Francisco, you know, I could take my car, or I could go by BART, or I could get somebody else to give me a ride, or I could go by a motorcycle. There's all kinds. I could walk even. There's all kinds of different ways to get there, and there's many different routes also. So I can say all these paths lead to the same goal. I can also say, even in getting a quiet mind, there are countless meditative techniques and just worldly techniques to really quiet my mind. Oh, there's so many. All these paths lead to the same goal. They all lead to a quiet mind. But what about knowledge? You know? What is the means of knowledge? You know? Do all paths lead to the same goal in reference to knowledge? You know? In knowledge, you need a means of knowledge, which is true, which has the capacity to give you knowledge of the object of knowledge. Like, say, for instance, if I want to see what that painting looks like, I want to see the painting, then I need to use my eyes to see the painting, because the eyes are capable of giving me that knowledge. It's the same with all, you have to study the different means of knowledge and what these means of knowledge that we have available to us, what knowledge are they capable of giving us? So say I want to know myself. Do I want to know myself through hearing? Or do I want to know myself through seeing? Or do I want to know myself through inference? Or all of the means of knowledge I have available to me, which means of knowledge are going to give you knowledge of yourself? These are all really, in the East, they're very, very important questions. I have to know how I know what I know. Because we're talking about knowledge. See, the thing is, you are all here. Each one of us. I am here. I'm not somewhere else. I'm here. My problem is that I don't know who I am. Like for all of us, until you know, you don't know. Say, I am here. I am a conscious, existent being. You know? But is this me that I am, this conscious being that I am, is it a byproduct of this body? I don't know. Will it die when the body dies? I know I'm a conscious being, but what is its relationship with my body? I know I'm a conscious being, but is the conscious being that I am a soul that is inhabiting the body? You know, different from you, and you're a soul that's inhabiting the body, and then maybe we'll go to heaven or hell or whatever. Maybe, because religions say that, but I actually don't know. See what I mean? So what I do know is that I am, I exist, I am a conscious being. And I don't know that because I'm looking at it. It's not like you're looking at consciousness. Say, oh, yes, I'm a conscious being. There I am right there. No, you're not looking at it. You're not objectifying it. You are the bottom line. You say, I know I'm a conscious being because I'm a conscious being. That's just how it is. I'm a conscious being. Not because I'm looking at it like I'm looking at the chair or like I'm looking at the physical body. But that's the problem. I know I'm a conscious being, but I have no way to know what this conscious being that I am is. And when we want to gain self-knowledge, we're in a difficult situation because our means of knowledge, even though I know I am and I exist and I am right here, I don't really know how to know me specifically what I am. You see what I mean? I know that I am, but I don't, and I have my own self-experience, but I don't know what this self-experience is. Like, for instance, if the Vedanta says, you are the one self in all beings. In fact, you are the one non-dual reality. If I tell you that, you go, really? Is that right? That's going to be, that's a wild belief. It's just a belief, right? For you to be able to see that, there has to be a teaching methodology, in a sense, in which the Upanishads are, that hold up a mirror. They hold up a mirror to what your eyes can't turn around and look at, so that you see and understand that. But there's a lot of understanding that has to take place to be able to go from myself as wandering here, this conscious being, I'm this physical body, from going from this position to recognizing I am this whole. That's a big jump. There's a lot of steps involved in getting me to that recognition that is not a belief, but it's knowledge. Right? To a knowledgeable recognition of that. It's just like, you know, if you have a dream and there's a dream character in the dream, so you're having a solid dream, and look at the dream character in the dream is a mumukshu, you know, that wants self-knowledge. For that dream character to really know what's going on, it's going to take a lot of teaching. Because that dream character is going to have to recognize that its very self is the self of the whole dream. So you have to go from that little dream character to being the whole. So there's Shravana, Manana, and then there's what they call Nididhyasana. Here it's Dhyanam. Dhyanam, contemplation, Nididhyasana. Because say, in the unfoldment of this teaching and the resolution of all of your doubts, even with that, you have lifetimes, beginning of lifetimes, of taking yourself to be this physical body, to be this individual. And so it's like the dream character recognizing, the dream character gets a dream guru and recognizes, sees very clearly, whoa, this whole thing, including my body, mind, sense organs, this whole thing, you know, this body, mind, sense organs actually belongs to the whole dream. It's part and parcel of the whole dream. It's a part to the whole. And this whole thing actually comes from me, the conscious being. The dream comes from me, is sustained by me, resolves into me, and every part of it. I'm not just this body, I am everything. I am the self of the whole dream, not just the self of this body. So with good teaching, with solid teaching, that dream character sees this clearly. You know, and then goes to work, goes off to work.
Oh, no.
You know, gets stuck in the subway, and then this and that happens, and this and that, the mind just gets pulled out, and, you know, it has to be brought back. Because the world is so real, right? The world is so real because the body, mind, sense organs and all of your samskaras and everything are all, you know, engaged in this duality. And so that dhyanam, that contemplation, which helps to just bring the mind back to being that and seeing that reality, you know, is necessary for some time, you know, pulling the mind back when it gets lost and then pulling it back. It gets lost until it's not necessary to pull it back. You know? They use an example, I think it's in the Gita, that this knowledge is like, say, if Swamiji tells it like this, that say along the beach, some kids build a huge, huge bonfire. They bring in driftwood and came from all over the place, and they build this giant bonfire that now has to be lit. Okay? And so they have a little match to light this huge thing. Right? And so they with a little bit of wind, they have the match and they have to protect it, you know, and just get it started in a little corner. It's a great big bonfire. They have to start in this little corner and get it lit, you know, and then gently protect it from the wind, because if too much wind comes, it'll just immediately blow it out. So they protect it until it starts to catch flame, you know. And then there comes a point where you're still protecting it and, you know, making sure it has plenty of kindling and all of that. But there comes a point where the flame, you know, enjoys the wind. It enjoys the wind, and it enjoys the big pieces of logs, you know. It just starts eating them up like crazy. And the more the wind, the more the flames come. And at that point, there's no one, you don't have to bother, because it's on its own. It's on its own. It will just burn up the whole bonfire, you know. But in the beginning, there's this kind of, you know, taking care. So imagine here our situation. If you use the whole how we view it in Vedanta, beginningless births, countless births. And every birth, here we are as an individual, a character in the dream, looking out through our sense organs, you know, doing this and that to become happy. Lifetimes and lifetimes after lifetimes of some scars, thinking my happiness is out here, I have to carve my own way and all of that. Lifetimes of it with none of the other. Maybe just a little hopeful intuitions here and there, you know. Until now. And now, one little match comes. One little match of a class comes, right? And strikes that, all those billions of vrittis that are there. So many in unmanifest condition, just waiting to pop out, you know? So it has to be tended. So that bonfire for a while of all of these vrittis that are all associated totally with duality, you know, it takes a while before this knowledge really has the strength to gobble up the other vrittis, you know. Just as an example, when I was in India in the 70s, I was in India for quite some years, but after 2 or 3 years or so, I had to come back for visa problems and redo my visa. But I had been living in an ashram where all I did day in and day out was study Vedanta and contemplate and have satsang, study Sanskrit. I never went out. I didn't want to go out. I just wanted to be there. But that's all we did. And so here it's time to go home and do this visa stuff. And so I get on the plane and I come home and I land in Berkeley, where I had left from Berkeley. My parents lived in Sonoma, but I had spent many, many years living in Berkeley. Came home to Berkeley to all of my old friends and family members and everything. And thoughts and feelings I had not had for 4 years. I didn't even know they existed. I'd forgotten. But they were all in storage. They were all in unconscious storage. And when I came back out into those same situations, the same type of thoughts and situations and feelings and all of that rose up again. Same. Identical, you know? And I recognized them, I remembered them. But you know what the difference was? It shocked me, because that was my first experience with that, because I hadn't been home for so long. It really shocked me. But there was a big difference. And the difference was that all of these old thoughts that were identical to what I used to have came up into a new person, in a sense. They came up into a new buddhi, right? So it's like those logs, you know, came into a fire that wasn't there before. And they did have to come up. And they did. But as they came up, they were totally, in a sense, dissipated by me, by my buddhi, as it was now. You know? And so I think that's what it is. It's like you're that nididhyasana, that dhyanam, has to be done for some time, you know, because the mind isn't strong enough. I'd been there for 2 or 3 years, and so I had a certain strength that would have been different, say, if I had come home after a week. That's different than coming home after 3 years if all you've done is inundate yourself in Vedanta for 3 years and then you come back. Your buddhi has a little bit of strength, you know, to be able to handle. It was a shock that these things come up, but there was somebody there to kind of pull them into my knowledge, because you have knowledge there. So that's the dhyanam. It says dhyanam is necessary, that meditation, contemplation is necessary for what we call viparita bhavana. Viparita bhavana means when I take myself to be other than what I am. You know, habitually. The mind is habitual like that. So you need to be able to bring the mind back. You know, when it just runs out as it's used to doing. But remember that when the mind is, once you have knowledge, when the mind is running out, you know, there's still a buddhi there, an intellect there, somebody that has knowledge, that knows what's happening. You know, and can help it to come back. You know, and the reason, why does it need to come back? It doesn't need to come back. If it's running, when it's running around doing its thing, it isn't causing you pain. If it's running around in part of Ishwara and all is well, you know, that's fine. It can run around all at once. But what about when the jiva is evoked? You know, the one that says, I'm not going to be happy if that happens. If that happens, I'm going to be destroyed. If this happens, I don't have a life left. I'm going to be a miserable person, you know? All of the type of projections, if that happens, then I have to bring, you know, I have to bring that mind back because it's gone kind of off track. So I bring it back until it doesn't go off track. That's what the dhyanam is. That's the sadhana. The shravana manana the nididhyasana is the sadhana. So he says, now in this verse, you know, In these 10 verses, this sarvatmaktvam is something that now it's been made very, very clear. And therefore, you know, you do shravana, manana, nididhyasana on this. You know, you let your mind all of the time, so you do that all of the time. And what one other thing? Sankirtanat. And also you in satsang, you stay in satsang because you keep the company of the good, you know. You keep the company of the good so that your mind doesn't get pulled away. And you share it with others. You tell others. Tell others means in satsang, when you discuss with others, because that keeps your mind in it. So he says, the shravana, manana, nididhyasana, and teaching, or, you know, sharing with others, as Swamiji will say, sankirtanas, sharing with others, you know, from doing that, then, as we'll see this other part, this next two lines next week, from doing that, gaining knowledge through that means, then that sarvatmaktvam, the ishwaratvam, the being the whole, I am the whole, that is something which occurs naturally. It occurs naturally because you already are that. In other words, that's not something for you to do, it's something which you are. So that nishta in that recognition occurs naturally. But let's do that. We'll do those next two lines next week. Let's take a break. Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vashishyate Om Shanti 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 Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Harihi Om.